This is 20VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and what a show we have in store for you today. I actually first heard this guest speak at SASTA, and I've wanted to make this show happen ever since, and so I'm thrilled to welcome Jay Simons, general partner at Bond, with their debut growth fund back in 2019. They made their mark on the venture landscape, and have since made investments in the likes of Revolut, Canva, Nextdoor, Ironclad, and my personal favourite, On Running. As for Jay, prior to entering venture, he spent an incredible 12 years at Atlassian, including 9 years as president, playing an instrumental role in their hypergrowth journey. Jay's also a board member with both Zapier and HubSpot, two of my favourite SaaS companies also. And I do want to say huge thanks to Alex and Richard Excel and Atlassian founder Scott Farquhar for some fantastic question suggestions today that made such a difference. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple, schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minute VC to sign up. Plus, 20VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. But it's now time for the show, and I'm so excited to hand over to Jay Simons, general partner at Bond Capital.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Jay, it is such a joy to have you on the show today, my friend. I've heard so many great things from Scott at Atlassian, Alex at Excel, and Juliet on your team at Bond. So thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm lucky to be here.
That is very, very kind of you. But I do want to start with some context. I always love a bit of background. So how did you make your way into the world of venture and come to be a GP today at Bond?
Well, I've spent the last 25 years building companies. And the last 12, I was at Atlassian building out go-to-market and the business operation there. And joined the board of HubSpot, a company called HubSpot, about 4 years ago. Just got a lot of gas in the tank from ability to help that company in that particular capacity in that role. And at the same time, I began investing personally in younger companies and mentoring and meeting founders. Both of those two things I drew a lot of energy from. And so after 25 years of building companies, I could choose between rebooting and single threading on another company that I could help build and grow, or taking the accumulated merit badges and experiences and scar tissue and trying to be useful across more dimensions and a bunch of different companies and different markets and different founders and different stages of growth. And that's what I was attracted to.
I mean, I totally don't blame you. I love the breadth that venture allows, but I want to start on something quite strange almost, but I listened to your discussion with Alex now at Excel, and in that discussion you mentioned actually being in Asia and being a musician in Asia when you were very young. It just struck me as quite a transformative moment of someone's life being in Asia at such a young age on your own. How do you think it impacted your mindset and who you are today?
Yeah, I was a young kid from a small town on the coast of Washington State, and I'd gone to college in Seattle, but Seattle at the time was a pretty small and provincial place. So to suddenly land in Seoul, Korea, and Tokyo, and Burma was incredibly eye-opening and just an incredible experience. opened my perspective a lot, taught me, you know, to look for and appreciate differences, helped me to listen more carefully. I mean, when you're in places where they're not speaking your language and they can speak a part of your language way better than you can speak part of theirs, you really have to tune your ears and you have to slow down and kind of connect with human beings on a different level. So that taught me a lot, I think, and helped shape me. I was in my 20s for a period of time, kind of all over Asia, playing piano. And so sort of the other superpower that I kind of took out of that experience was I learned how to play my way, the Frank Sinatra song, in every key. So whoever wanted to sing it could, on demand.
I do also have to start on some other kind of quite out there element, which is we mentioned Alex, and he told me that I had to ask very specifically about the story of the wise brass owl. And he gave you his permission to tell you the story. So what's the story of the wise brass owl?
Yeah, that's a personal story. Alex and I were in the foxhole together in the earliest years of building Atlassian. And much of Atlassian's young operational maturity, he deserves a lot of credit for building. Alex left Atlassian to move home to the East Coast with his family and gave me a parting gift. This little brass owl, actually, I've got it here on my desk, this little figurine. He gave it to me as a reminder of both our friendship and what we've been building together, and as a reminder of the power of observation and wisdom. And he probably said something more pithy than this, but you know that old quote that you probably learned as a kid, you know, a wise old owl sat in an oak. The more he saw, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we be like that wise old bird? Anyway, you know, fast forward a number of years and we finally went public in 2015. And along the roadshow, the 2 weeks of the roadshow, I brought that little owl with me. And Atlassian had come so far, and a lot of it was because of Alex in the early days. And I wanted him to be there for that part of the journey, even though he'd left the company. And when we got to the listing day, we listed on the NASDAQ, I put it next to the NASDAQ button and sent him a picture. Still, I keep that little owl on my desk, you know, as a reminder of the friendship that Alex and I formed in those early years. But to me, it's also a reminder that incredible people make incredible businesses.
I do want to dive in, though, and it's on something that you said to me before, which I thought was particularly pertinent and would be a great starting point, which is the best companies build economies around themselves. So what did you mean by this? And what are those different components?
Well, I think this is true for any company, consumer companies, you know, as well as enterprise companies. I'll focus on enterprise companies with the one I know best, you know, Atlassian as an example. We were very intentional at Atlassian in thinking about the economies that we could help build around us. A partner economy of resellers and service providers. A marketplace economy of developers and independent software companies building add-ons and extensions to our products that filled a need for our customers that we weren't filling. A job economy where the credentials and expertise people could build around our products was something that they'd get hired for. They'd get their next job because of that, and on and on. Eventually, your alumni network is an economy. The culture and the people that you grow up through your company that move on to other companies are part of the company or the economy that can thrive around you. You know, I think the word economy is really important here because there's livelihood, incentives, motivations, values, the need for management and investment. Each of those that I mentioned have their own unique built-in network effects and transitive properties back to the business around both growth and defensive moats. So I think the components vary company to company, but generally they're probably drawn along that triangle of customers, partners, developers.
When's the right time, if we think about kind of many founders listening, when's the right time for founders to think about building out that economy beyond just building product and getting initial users to love it? When should they think about economy building?
I think in the earliest days of the company, in the formation of the company, you know, as you're building the product, I think you should be thinking, what are the economies, the extensions of our business that we can invest in that will have transitive properties back to our own company? And, you know, when we thought about it, even sort of one of the examples that I mentioned, a partner economy of resellers and solution providers, I think Atlassian now probably has over 500 of those. And these are individual companies that are hiring and creating culture and exploring dimensions of Atlassian's market that Atlassian doesn't have the time or capacity to really think through. You know, I think if you're a company that thinks about that and you architect it right, you're creating kind of these independent businesses that think exclusively about your business. So your growth is their growth and vice versa. And they're cheering fanatically for you. And they hustle like on your behalf. So, you know, whether it's a partner that's doing some value-added service that I mentioned or a developer building something on top of your platform or a customer champion that believes that their next pay increase is going to come from the expertise that you've helped them develop, they're all hustling on your side of the field. And that hustle and the growth that's related to it compounds like any growth. You know, you build just these networks networks of people out in the world that kind of row in your boat for you. That can be incredibly powerful when done right.
Can I ask, when you're investing today, do you actively look for these economies within the investments that you make? And I guess, what are the signs within founders' speech, actions, that signal to you that they clearly understand the importance of this economy building around the core business?
I do. I look for either the early formation of them or the ability to form them. And, you know, just I think the belief kind of in a founder or a company that there is an opportunity for businesses to build around your platform or your company. We drew a lot of inspiration from Microsoft, which I think is a textbook case here. And over the decades, they've done just an incredible job of continuing to build and grow economies around the Microsoft business across all the dimensions that I highlighted and more. But I think if you look back on time, before they had the brand and direct reach that they have today, they had reach through this incredibly durable partner ecosystem and the customer economy built around getting Microsoft certified and having that sort of credential be part of your identity. And that takes, you know, I think there's different moves that they could have made early on, but sort of they chose to invest in extensions of themselves. I think those extensions have made them, in addition to the technology and innovation, all of the other things that they've done as a business, but has made them the durable, incredible business that they've become over generations.
What do you think are the biggest challenges in terms of building out these economies? You mentioned Microsoft, there's obviously Atlassian, there's many others in play today. What do you think are the biggest challenges that are maybe common throughout in terms of that economy build out?
Maybe a big one is you have to have trust that a third party or a partner or somebody that's an extension of you can do things as well as you could. In some cases, they're going to do things differently. In some cases, they need to do the same things. And, you know, we invested at Atlassian, we invested early on. We had built this self-service online e-commerce flywheel for customers to buy the product. And as we moved into the enterprise, we had an opportunity to either invest directly in building an enterprise sales organization or indirectly in investing in a partner network and a channel that could help resell our products into larger companies around the globe, but also service and support and configure and install and upgrade all those products. And that requires a lot of faith. When you're a young company, you could say, well, I know what I need to do. I know how to do this. And probably it's a more sure-footed path for me just to do that directly. And it takes both faith, investment, patience to invest in an alternative, but you've got to believe that that alternative provides this sort of long-term, durable, positive benefit to the company. There's some tension in that. I think there's also tension in continuing to invest in it. Even if you pick channel as sort of one component of economy that you can build, I think, you know, history is sort of littered with examples of companies that begin to build out a channel as either greed or kind of the desire for growth becomes more acute. Potentially, the company can kind of push their channel down the value stack, where early on, the channel has the ability to kind of work with the biggest, most valuable customers. And over time, maybe a direct sales organization says, well, we're going to take that segment and run it directly because it's more valuable and important to us. And you'll take the mid-market segment or the SMB segment. And what I see happen a lot is the channel loses opportunity. They begin to diversify and they say, well, actually, instead of exclusively focusing on building a business around this one software company, I actually needed more things in my portfolio. I need to de-risk my concentration on this one thing. And overall, if you think about it, then they become less valuable to you over time because their focus is fragmented. They're now thinking about two companies or three companies or four companies instead of exclusively yours. And that requires, I think, fortitude and learning and patience and investment, but it's not easy.
I'm really interested on this kind of partner network kind of thinking, especially around the timing, because I often have founders who say, oh, we're going to have a partner network that's going to help us scale to 5 million in ARR. And I say, no, you don't have the brand to convert through a partner network when they don't have that kind of founder-led sales or team-led sales. And then also on the retention side, if it's not a star service, which it might not be, again, you don't have the brand to kind of retain. How do you think about, like, when's the right time to build that partner network? Because for me, I don't think it's day one. I think you have to reach a certain height. Am I right or am I missing this?
Well, you need market there. I mean, you need market for the partners to be able to grow their businesses. And then I think you need alignment around what they do and what you do and where you work together and where some of the rubs will be. In our particular case, part of the catalyst for building the partner network was this need that we weren't directly fulfilling in the enterprise segment with a need geographically. You know, we were selling online in US dollars. And so part of the value add that a partner could support us through is I can sell in euros or I can sell in in Japanese yen. And I can invoice you locally because you're going to buy online from effectively a US and Australian entity, and you might want an invoice with a local address for tax reasons. That was sort of like one thing that the partner could fulfill. The other thing that was really symbiotic with our particular approach is there was a service opportunity in our products for partners to service. They could configure, tune, customize, deploy. There's a kind of a bunch of things that potentially a large customer would need help with that we could either choose to invest directly, or we could choose to invest through a partner to service those kinds of things. And I think one of the mistakes maybe that companies make is, and I learned this in the company prior to Atlassian, there's a gravitational pull towards sort of the big service integrators, right? The Deloittes and the Accentures and sort of like the really big companies. And they take a lot of time because, again, they've got a kajillion things that they're focused on and lots of different technology in the practice of the firm that they're talking to. We focused on kind of more boutique, dedicated partners that we could invest and actually get more return on that investment with their focus and dedication to our products and our market. And then because we structured it in a way that really advantaged their ability to build a business in a market, they didn't need to kind of look around for other things to diversify their business. We gave them so much opportunity to grow. And then back to at the top of kind of this item, that growth compound positive properties back to us. It meant that as they hired, you know, more salespeople or more services people, those employees of that little boutique consulting company, when they went from 20 people to 40 people to 60 people, they all didn't carry Atlassian business cards, but man, they woke up every day thinking about Atlassian, our market, our customers. I mean, their livelihoods were aligned with what we were trying to build.
Can I ask, when I think about this, I mean, the big thing I hear is that you have to be a really meaningful part of their business, if not the sole part of their business, because you have to be aligned in that way. How do you think about equipping your team to manage that partner network? What does that internal infrastructure look like to ensure that you get the best from the partner network?
In our particular case, it is about architecting a program that has clarity around the purpose and the mission, and where you're aligning with the partners that you're recruiting into that program, what's going to happen. On top of that program, you know, we didn't have salespeople in the field, but we had, at the time, what we called experts. We referred to our partners as experts because we wanted to signal to, you know, the market and to our customers that there are companies alongside us that have deep expertise in our products. And that's actually what you want. You want somebody that really knows how to take Atlassian products and put them to work inside of your business. And so we're going to represent not a reseller, not a VAR, not a service provider. We're going to represent an expert to you. We invested in developing that expertise in these companies. So we didn't have field salespeople, but we had expert managers around the world who were deeply focused on recruiting, enabling, assisting, helping, managing this network of affiliated partners and partnerships. Also understanding what could we do better inside of the company, inside of the program, inside of the products to enable their growth, because their growth would yield more growth for us.
How do you feel about the importance of partner networks, channel networks, and those providers in a world of much more kind of democratized product-led growth?
I think it can be a little trickier if there isn't something for the partner to be able to do with your product. If your product is so simple and so easy that the barrier to entry in the product is literally a sign-up form and I'm in, and the product basically doesn't need configuration or training or assistance or help, and there isn't something that you can stretch it around to do that requires expertise or prior experience, it's going to be harder. And it may be that then you have more of a partner orientation around reselling or training, you know, some other thing that the partner could do. But I think it's important to understand, like, if I'm going to build this network of affiliated relationships, what are they? And by the way, the other dimension that I mentioned was, it was important to us, is we had extensibility in Atlassian products from a really early age. And so one thing that partners could do is they could extend them and kind of build add-ons and customizations individually for specific customers. But third parties and independent developers could also use those same extensions to build products they could sell into our customer base. And that was, again, a huge area of investment for us, where we focused on making sure that the APIs and extension points were richer and richer and richer for individuals to do things with and small companies to do things with, but also that we created a way to marry customer with product that wasn't our own. And the goal for us is somebody solved the problem that actually a lot of our customer base probably wants access to. And if they do get access to that and it does solve a problem, it means that both the core product is more valuable to them, and the core product product from a retention perspective is even stickier because you've got Jira, and then you have three or four things that are built around it that are really valuable to the customer base. That value actually means that our retention is going to be higher and it becomes kind of a more meaningful, sticky product to the customer overall. So it's just another example of, even if you don't, in a product-led growth business, you might not have the same opportunity with kind of resellers and value-added service providers, but you could potentially have the same opportunity for independent software vendors or individual developers to build a whole bunch of extension value on top of your core product.
When you think about like the success you had in terms of building this out with Atlassian, when you think back now, is there anything you would do differently, you would have done earlier, you wouldn't have done? Is there anything that you would do differently when you look back at the journey you had in terms of building out this network at Atlassian?
Man, I don't know. The counterfactuals are always hard because, you know, we made some pretty unconventional choices around strategy and where we were going. And it's always hard to say, well, what if we had gone right instead of left? It's hard to say. I mean, I'm proud of the choices that we made. We spent a bunch of time debating them. And there's unconventional things like, you know, we added a second product really early in the company's life cycle. That was a very unconventional and risky choice. But I think if I look back, had we not done that, we probably would be a very different company. Who knows? Like if we were just the Jira company and not Atlassian that has a portfolio of products, how different would we be? I think that we wouldn't be the company that Atlassian became. We also deferred focus on the enterprise segment for about 10 years. We were still selling into the enterprise, but we were selling differently to the enterprise and really not kind of maximizing the value that we probably should capture for the value that we were giving really large companies. We deferred that focus and that ability to capture that value for a number of years. And I think as a strategic choice, that helped us competitively because we were a different shaped company for enterprises. We were still being adopted at the user level and brought into organizations. But the alternatives to us were all orders of magnitude more expensive with different distribution and sales models. And in the early days, they were growing faster than us, but you know, we grew more durably. You know, Atlassian grew between 40 and 50% for more than 15 straight years. I mean, there's lots of things that I think I wish we would have done faster and earlier. When you look in the rearview mirror, velocity is the thing you always want to challenge. You're like, oh man, it just took us too long to do this thing. I think the thing that we did was right. We just should have done it in half the time. You know, over time, I think we got better at prioritization. We got better at being declarative, but then making sure that the other things that we could invest partial time or sort of like bubble along, we basically just put on ice. And we said, we're not going to do those because this thing is so critical to our future and success. We're concentrating all of our energy on that thing and we're going after it. And probably that's the thing, if I could go back in history and change, I would have developed that capability and matured it a lot earlier.
And speaking of kind of putting it on ice and that concentration of energy, I think a massive question for founders is like, when's the right time to build that secondary or ancillary product? I know it's very different dependent on market, product insertion point, a lot of different factors, but how do you think about kind of the core of when's the right time to add that second product and really start building out the product portfolio if that's the strategy you want to take?
I think it's more common. A more common mistake is companies probably wait too long versus doing it too early. I think history is littered with examples of great companies that didn't invest in, you know, a durable second act. And they're putting all their energy in the first act. And eventually the first act runs out of gas or steam. And then it's too late. Then you're in sort of that wartime save the first act mode versus, you know, investing in the optionality of kind of that second product or that second act of growth. I think it's impossibly prescriptive about timing because it is so situational. But the advice I'd probably give, always have some part of you, some part of the company, thinking about new innovation, new problems to solve for customers, and just investing in that. You know, in Atlassian's case, our second product, Confluence, was created in year two of the company, which was incredibly risky, I think, to diversify focus so early. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think it was foundational to the company Atlassian became. It was very much a high beta move, right? High risk, high reward. But that move also led to early explorations in M&A because we understood how to manage multiple things in the product portfolio. And we understood the virtues of building out that portfolio. Those are all muscles that every company ultimately needs to develop. If you're going to be a big generational company, you actually have to have more than one thing. And you probably have to have the ability to build them organically and acquire them. I think there are absolutely pros and cons to building them too early or building them too late. And it's hard to find the Goldilocks zone.
I mean, speaking of kind of developing new muscles, I do want to touch on the very exciting moves that you've made recently in terms of the move to be obviously GP at Bond. And so if we start with first 100-ish days in venture, what's the biggest surprise?
Biggest surprise is probably 98% of the job spending times on things you'll say no to.
Do you find that tough? Because I do. You look back on your day and you might as well have done nothing if you actually want to look at like productive work done.
I do find it tough. You're looking for, you're building out, a portfolio, and the portfolio is going to be selective. In my particular case, I'm probably choosing 4 or 5 companies, over the course of 12 to 18 months that I want to deploy a lot of capital into, but also deploy a lot of time and energy and attention. And so even though to that degree, it makes sense to sort of spend a lot of time qualifying out. It's hard. It's sort of like your time is inverted, where the majority of it is filtering the things that you're going to pass on, you're going to say no to try to find those 4 or 5 really special companies that you want to marry.
Can I ask a weird one? Is it harder than you thought? I think, for a lot of founders and incredible execs I speak to, you kind of go, what do you VCs do all day? Like, is it harder than you thought?
In some dimensions, it is. I think what's hard for operators that move into investing, it's easy to sort of look at things through the lens of maybe what you do as an operator. And so that challenge is you can see maybe a lot of potential in lots of businesses based on what you believe would be the right focus or execution. And that's based on what you've been through and what you've built and what you've seen. That can be a challenge because I think, I've seen lots of great businesses that potentially could be exceptional. And by the way, that's true of any investment, but sort of like the right execution and kind of right strategy and right focus. But, I think the day-to-day job I found thrilling, right? The opportunity to spelunk into different markets and different products and different founders and different stages of growth is awesome. Having spent 25 years really single threading on one thing where I wake up every day thinking about one market and only the dimensions of that one company, to have the opportunity, be blessed with the opportunity to learn about a lot of different markets and products and problems that you're solving is just exhilarating.
Can I ask, I had a very seasoned exec turned VC on the show the other day, and they said the hardest element is writing that first check. It's like having the conviction to write the first check as an institutional investor and, put the first badge on the portfolio board. How did you embrace that? How was that moment for you?
My first check was a company I'd known for a while. It was a company called Century.io. They provide software to help developers monitor and fix errors and performance in their code and the applications that they're building. And so part of the big secular shift around software eating everything and the importance of software development teams. So it was sort of one that I was close to based on my 12 years at Atlassian, but incredible product, fanatical customers. And like Atlassian, the ability to serve small and huge customers simultaneously. It's kind of daunting when you write the first one. I think maybe the hard part about investing in general is you can, it's easy to imagine what a company is going to look like 2 years into the future. Lots of investing is closing your eyes and building some assumptions around what the company could look like 5 to 10 years into the future. And that's hard because so much can change, right? Markets can change. New competitors can kind of enter the market. You can have big tectonic shifts in a particular category that can create headwinds for that company. It's really difficult to predict the future with certainty that far out. That's actually, I think, anytime you're writing a check, whether it's like early stage or even in growth stage, and you're saying, man, what do I need to believe about this company 5 or 6 or 7 years from now? When you're writing the check, that's hard. It takes a lot of time and energy to understand the market and the founders and the product and the customers and the problems they're solving, but also just faith and gut and belief.
I almost find that easier. It's probably a little bit different for me at the early stage, but for me, I'm like, market timing, I'm not smart enough to predict it. The product is transient. So all I've got in front of me is Scott and Mike and Jay, and do I fundamentally believe that whatever may happen, they might be the ones to guide it to where it could be? Do you know what I mean? I almost find that simplistic thinking almost the easiest with that.
Oh yeah, it's back to the owl, right? Incredible people make incredible businesses. Even when I think about Atlassian, Atlassian probably in Excel's portfolio was probably, I'm guessing, rated as, maybe a B company, because our growth profile wasn't, we weren't growing at 100%. We were not slow, but we were steady and we were really intentional about how we were growing. So I imagine inside of Excel's portfolio, they would have seen companies that at our revenue size were growing twice as fast, probably said, man, there's other things Atlassian could be doing to grow faster. Ultimately, 10 years later, we eclipsed a lot of those companies based on core strategic decisions we made and how thoughtful we were about really long-term growth and building the foundations for that durable long-term growth. And it was very intentional. We made choices where we could have really early on invested in the enterprise segment, and instead of selling a $10,000 product, chose to sell a $200,000 product. And again, the counterfactual is tough to paint what Atlassian would have looked like, but I believe it wouldn't be the same company that it is today had we done that.
My almost concern with today is the fact that actually with capital markets where they are, Atlassian, if it was today in its 2-3 year formation, say the first years, it would have been so stuffed with capital from so many different multi-stage crossover funds, you name it, that actually it could have been so diverted from the beauty and simplicity of what it was. Do you think that's fair?
You know, again, it depends on the situation. I think there's businesses that need capital that you need to blitz scale because, like, there's an opportunity that was so large and so meaningful that if you're not chasing it as quickly as you can, somebody else is. And the first to get there is probably going to be the winner take most. I think there's certainly examples of that. Then there's examples where, you know, I think capital scarcity can also benefit you. You know, we were forced to kind of fund the business from the cash register. And I think that created, you know, a discipline. It created a compelling need to really, really materially understand ROI. And so anywhere we are going to spend money, we are going to analyze the crap out of that just to make sure, is this money well spent? You know, we could still be speculative and we could still experiment and try things, but every experiment was thought through. What are we trying to prove here? And how do we know that this is working or not working? And I think if you're not capital constrained, potentially you're not doing that because you don't have to. But, you know, I think it's a horses for courses thing. It really depends on, you know, the situation, the market, the competitive landscape, and how you're choosing to compete.
I do agree with you totally, but I do want to dive into a quick fire round, Jay, having completely flunked the schedule. Let's at least retain some sense of structure. So I'm going to say a short statement. You give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
Okay, so let's start with the favorite book. What's the must read for me?
The River Why by David James Duncan is probably the novel I've reread the most. And it is a meditation on self-discovery and nature and life told through the journey of the soul-searching fisherman in the Pacific Northwest, which is where I grew up. And so kind of the backdrop of the book is really familiar to me because that's where I spent my childhood. But it is just a beautifully written and moving portrait of someone trying to figure themselves out.
What would you most like to change about venture today?
I'll give you two things. Like, one is, I think, more long-term orientation, you know, especially in the early days. I think it's easy to say this company needs to focus on the triple, triple, double, double, double. And I think if that's what you're trying to accomplish, you may build the rails that you're going to run on in a particular way. Make no mistake, there's great businesses that began with a triple, triple, double, double and kind of went on to be generational companies. Then there's businesses that do that and there were different rails that potentially their company could move on that they didn't invest in. And, you know, Atlassian, you know, was never a triple, triple, double, double company. It was this kind of methodical, reasonable grower. But the thing that we concentrated, like our North Star was we believed in ubiquity. We believed that we had products that irregardless of size and shape, every company in the world should use one or more of Atlassian products. And that's actually what we set out to accomplish. We talked a lot about the Fortune 500,000, not the Fortune 500. And every decision that we made was optimized around how do we accomplish that goal. That required patience, by the way. I think early in Atlassian's formative years, probably people would have said, you're not growing fast enough. Like, do things to grow faster. Like, you should be tripling, you should be doubling at kind of your small revenue size. But I think we would have made different decisions that, you know, who knows? I mean, potentially would have produced a similar outcome, potentially wouldn't. It's hard to say.
Best board member that you've sat on a board with and why?
Lori Norrington, an absolute treasure. Sit on the HubSpot board with Lori. She is just steeped in decades of operating experience from Intuit and eBay and has been a great independent director on lots of incredible boards. Just a wonderful, smart, insightful human being. She has a gift for asking a question or shaping a suggestion in a way that's just so accessible to answer or accessible to consider. I think that's a gift because oftentimes somebody can ask a question and it can feel like I'm trying to show you how insightful my question is versus really trying to understand something more deeply, or I'm going to make a suggestion that shows that, you know, I'm the smartest person in the room or something. She's just zero ego, you know, 100% wrapped in empathy and experience. And whenever she speaks, it's just incredibly impactful.
Tell me, what do you believe that most around you disbelieve?
It's not hard to learn anything, like anything, to the point of enjoyment. And I think the thought of mastery intimidates you from just getting started. You know, like I've been a piano player my whole life and there's so many people that are like, oh man, I wish I could play piano. But I think the thought of I won't be great at it prevents people from even beginning. The thing I think people don't realize is it doesn't take much for you to get to a point where you'll be good enough just for yourself to enjoy it. Whether it's rock climbing or playing the guitar or understanding physics, you know, I think there's sort of a level of competency that isn't that hard to acquire with a little bit of time.
If you could have a gigantic billboard anywhere, what would you have on that billboard and why?
Be kind. Probably because I think, I don't know, it feels like in the world that we need more of that. You know, or maybe to continue the owl theme, be wise or give a hoot, don't pollute. I mean, we could go on and on. But I think the simplest expression of be a good human, be thoughtful and patient and receptive to those around you.
When was the last time your mind was blown and what was it with?
So this is a music thing, so pretty arcane. But there's a musician named Jacob Collier, who's a fellow countryman of yours, who has perfect pitch. And perfect pitch means he can sing precisely any note in tune. Jacob can do this thing where he can also sing microtones, which are sort of the tones in between regular notes. So if you look at a piano keyboard, you know, there are tones in between the keys that you can play with your fingers. His perfect pitch is so dialed in that as he's singing, he can slightly modulate the key so it's out of tune. And he does, there's a video on YouTube that just blew my mind where I think he was delivering this course at MIT and he played a chord on the piano and he began to sing the song. He took his hands off the keyboard and he began to sing the song. And to your ear, it sounded perfectly in key, but he had slightly modulated it to the point that a minute later when he played the chord, the piano was out of tune, or he was out of tune actually, but it made the piano sound out of tune. And it's just this dazzling innate ability. It's like watching somebody draw a human face at a photographic level. You're like mind blown, but it's just this innate superpower that, you know, you're born with, but to see it is like magic.
And then final one, what's the most recent publicly announced investment and why did you say yes and get so excited?
I mentioned Sentry. You know, Sentry is this company that helps developers monitor and fix performance and errors in their code. And, you know, incredible company, like 60,000 organizations that use it. It's a widely pervasive and popular open source project. Like Atlassian, the reason I got excited, it has the ability to serve customers of all shapes and sizes because there are developers inside of small teams and inside of gargantuan companies that need Sentry's product. And Sentry is going to make that development team more productive and ultimately the things that the development team is trying to produce run better.
Jay, this was such a joy to do. As I say, the best shows for me are the ones where we completely throw the schedule out the window. So I can't thank you enough for being so receptive to me doing that. And this has been so much fun.
Yeah, thanks, Harry.
I love that discussion with Jay and really so fascinating to deep dive on the build out of economies within companies there. And if you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, of course you can on the 20minutevc.com. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList Fund Admin platform to manage my investments. The team at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of the incredible platform that is AngelList on the business side there, on the personal side, Harness is the next generation wealth management solution created for builders, individuals founding, scaling, and investing in businesses. And if you're like me and not ready for an ongoing advisory relationship, then simple. Schedule a 1-hour tax planning session with a tax advisor experienced in working with equity. The accountant will review your equity and tax documents, answer any questions you may have, and provide projections for potential equity decisions. But don't just take my word for it. Harness have helped founders and early employees at companies like Stripe, UiPath, Affirm, and Coinbase capture more value with their finances. Go to harnesswealth.com/the20minute VC to sign up. Plus 20 VC listeners can receive $100 off their first year fees when they sign up for an advisor on the Harness platform by entering the 20 minute VC 08. And speaking of wealth management with Harness there, Masterworks is the first platform for buying and selling shares representing an investment in iconic artworks. Masterworks invite you to join an exclusive community investing in the most incredible blue chip art so you can invest in multi-million dollar paintings, buy and sell shares on secondary markets, and then receive the proceeds when the painting sells. And with more than $150 million in paintings purchased, Masterworks is the top buyer in the art market. So it's time to build your diversified portfolio of expertly vetted works curated by industry-leading research with Masterworks. And you can find out more today at masterworks.io. And that's a wrap for today. I cannot wait to bring you two more incredible episodes next week. Stay tuned and have a great weekend.